All right, we got the green light. So with that, I think we'll get started. We try to end up at length wide, like to run a tight program. We have a lot to do. By way of introduction, my name is Ed O'Connell. Really been here at the university a long time. My specialty is environmental health and safety. I'm the health physicist. I happen to be a very good friend of Professor Zweig, and that's through my union activity. I'm very much involved in the United University profession, which really represents the 34,000 both academic and professional workers through the whole city system, grievance officer and for professionals, and also a delegate and run up the health and safety committee. But it's a real big pleasure for me to be here. I know I look forward to Mike's conference, and as long as he's been doing it, I've really been part of it. It's a very, very important work that he runs through the center. And I was really interested in today's topics that will be coming, and if you're here, this is studies and service work. I'm sure they have some of the other programs going on. And so far, I think we have, and three of our speakers, like two of the talks being covered, and maybe just to get started, if we can just go around the room and have an introduction, and we have our speakers up front. I'll give a little bit of introduction when you're ready to go, but if you can just say hi to everyone, that'll be good. So, and here you are. Chalice, you can say, okay, so you're going to be our keynote speaker, which has a difficult name to pronounce, but I see. And Mustafa, I see. Now, I know you're interested in, your interest includes football. Is that National Football League? Yes. American style?
No.
I was just saying. Okay, now I know, the real football. Not the American version, that's good. So maybe we can just go table by table.
I'm Lou Martin.
Okay, another speaker. Lou will talk in 10 minutes.
What?
Introduce.
I've come.
And you're from where?
I am also from Turkey, Istanbul.
Okay, that's good. We've got a Turkey contingent here.
Hello, I am Ali. I'm a master's student in PhD here.
Okay.
But I'm originally, not originally, I'm from now.
Okay. Very international globalization, that's good. I'd like to see that.
Marquita Walker from Indiana University.
Okay, very good. You're one of our speakers, so that's good. I'll sign you in, and there's a disclosure statement as far as we can pass that back to her. Hey, yeah.
Dan Sidorik, I'm not a speaker. I adjunct at Temple University in Philly.
Oh, very good, welcome.
Gigi, and I'm a registered
nurse
from North New
Jersey. Okay, very good.
Joe Varga, Labor Studies in the University.
Excellent.
I'm Michelle, I'm from Newcastle University in the UK.
Oh, very good. Everyone's welcome. Well, just to kick us off, you know, we do have Chavez, I'm just probably wrecking the name, Sayan, and Mustafa Berkeley Aydin, and we're coming in from Turkey. Chavez is a research assistant in the Faculty of Communication Sciences at Anadolu University in Turkey. And Mustafa, I guess, has a lot of different interests, I guess, both culture, you mentioned the football already, media social movements, and you're a PhD candidate in the Middle Eastern Technical University, also at Turkey, and your thesis as talking about formation of Turkish working class, so it should really be very interesting. And we're going to kick you off with your talk, is Retail Workers, Working Conditions, Opinions, Organization, and Culture, a case study from Ankara, Turkey. Okay, so kick you off. I think we have the video, which is important. If you don't mind, I'll take some pictures too, some action shots. So if we go up to the slideshow.
Yeah.
On top, just over to this slideshow one should be right. And then it should, And that should be from the beginning?
From the beginning.
Okay. It's always about the video.
60s, especially in the 60s, with effect on political conjuncture, atmosphere, urbanization, and industrialization creates a working class movement. And trade unions have been an important improvement in this process, which especially with effects from political conjuncture in global world. But in that youth and peasant movement began linked with urban working class beginning in this time, we can say that. Importantly, this is another left-sided trade union in Turkey, founded in this year, in 1967, founded by established by opposition Turkish trade union leaders from them. And Turkey's breaking point, we said that in military court. Right-wing military coup has an important role of Turkey's political history, we can say that. When trade unions, leaders and members, social movement activists and politicians were arrested, all trade unions practically banned, except Turkish. All trade unions are banned in this period. Today, we can change today's general panorama. Turkish political area, historically, secular and conservative pro-Islamic tension has got interesting political situation in Turkish political context. With classes, of course, but this tension, secular and conservative tension, is important for understanding Turkish political context and class movements and social movements. In common knowledge, Turkish labor data about labor is not useful and correct at announcements by governmental institutions. For example, insured workers are the main concept for official data. However, everybody now knows that at least 50% of total Turkish labor force has not got any insurance. Everybody knows that, but in official data, you cannot find these numbers, etc. Another example can be defined in trade unions, the number of members. Inofficially, in state official documents, 53% of total workers in Turkey are unionized, but it is not true, it's totally wrong. Interestingly, governments and trade unions know this wrong ratio. These workers, ex-members, are generally using this ratio, and then insured workers are invisible in this ratio. But why? Why this situation? Because this situation can understanding in blocking approach in trade unions. In Turkey, government defines basic 28 branch of issues, basic 28 basic issues. In each of branch business, officially accredited trade union should have 10% of total branch of business workers. If trade unions data uses correctly, in Turkey only 4 or 5 trade unions have got accredited in their branch of business. So the situation provides mutual benefits for state-supported trade unions and state. It's a mutual benefit for them. In Turkey, civil servants, it's important point, I think, civil servants, trade unions and workers, trade unions organized in different areas. In this study, our main issue is about workers, trade unions and service workers, you must say that. In last 20 years, in general, trade unions have losing their power and members, except Hakish. It's a newly trendy trading in Turkey because of it is pro-Islamic worldview. Because in the last 10 years in Turkey, IKP government's goal and support Hakish in practically, not of course officially, but in practically, Hakish is supported by government, especially in last 10 years. Trade unions in Turkey, in general, we say that 28 branch of business. Turkey has not got many trade unions in this branch of businesses. On the other hand, three big effective trade union confederations active in Turkey. Turkish is the first one. Hakish is trendy trade union for the last 10 years. And this is the latest one in Turkey. Labor in Turkey, generally, we can say that women participation of working life is the least ratio of the EU countries. We can compare this ratio is interesting. But in service sector, women's participation of working life is more than other sectors in Turkey. It's interesting for in this sector, for this sector. Blind points I've got, I want to say this quote. Overall, the Turkish labor movement can be characterized as weaker than this president when compared with equivalent labor movements in the rest of the world. I think, in generally, is the summary. In Turkey, in general, this ratio for service sector, industrial sector, and agricultural sector in last 20 years, service sector growing, up. Generally, supermarkets and retail chains, small and independent stores in Turkish, we say in Turkish, bakka, this name. Mini markets, small stores, have a big problem with retail chains that has more affected in the last 10-15 years. Nearly over 200,000 workers work in retail chains in our studies, about our studies, in 2010. Experts estimate next 5 years, this maybe count to 35,000 works in chain. In general, quickly, of course, most from research.
I'll talk about our research in this part of our study. In study, we interviewed 58 workers from three different firms. 20 were from Migros. Also 19 from macro markets, also 17 from Kimsa. And also our interviews, realized 15 and 14 minutes. Also with two focus group meetings realized with main doubts of organization, life and expectation future plans. What working class and social inequalities. But we didn't ask directly what's working class. We asked firstly, what's about life? What's future plan? Are you happy with your job? And try to understand their perception about job and life because they are engaged most of the time. And in our interviews, 29 were women, 28 of our men. Workers' occupation range are very differently, especially cashiers, shop assistants, warehouse workers, medium administrative staff, butchers, employees in cooking, baking, and fish preparation, others, for example. Now, we will present some notes from the workers, their words and their perception of the life and their job perception. In general, maybe we can create some main types about workers. One of them is before marriage women. One of them is at the bottom. Another one is idle contemporary precarious worker. That last one is also university students. Also, for example, another note from a girl. I'm so bored when I work. However, I want to for money my daily cost. I will not stay on course. I am a teacher. I pity these workers who have got obligation to work here all life. I think it will be a nightmare. I like some of workers, but our world is so different. I said that before. It's only a short period bother for me. Also, they understand their job is a short time and not a continuous process and all the life. Just a little time before marriage, collect money. In Turkish, military is you have to go to the military before going to military. Some man trying to collect money to go to the market to work. And especially before marriage, form is widespread for gyms and macro market, also Islamic, based on Islamic capital, and also conservative people. And some days, in fact, many conservative people don't want to accept their daughters go out and work. But if the Ginseng market about is considered, it's normal. It's safe for them, especially parents of young girls, 21, 22. They want good marriage, many of them. But at present, it's interesting, they relied in focus group. For example, one of the nicknames Zeynep, she said that I want to live from work with marriage process. After this time, Zeynep retired herself and said about something working life. I want to say that, yes, who do not want to stay home? However, I can have a home by the work. My family absolutely doesn't give a permission if I don't go to work. But work and gain money is different experience. But also, my work is not interesting, but I can see new friends and many people there. And the same focus group, another woman adds something about Zeynep emphasizes. Say, do not be sure. Maybe you wouldn't let your work because, who will be your husband? Industrialist or footballer? Probably. He will not gain so much. So work with your obligation. For example, look me. I have children, but I work because I must have a work. But what do they think about trade union? Only pure regular migrant workers can member of trade union. The union name is Deskopish, that applies to Turkish Confederation, Berkatul Devat. Trade union and company have a good relations. Organization provided by company in the 18th, you can say control of work is its main purpose for the migrants by the union, the controlled union. Part-time workers and subcontracted firms workers are not camp members in Turkish law. Turkey of total Migros workers are members of this official interview. They generally emphasize high percentage of trade union cut-off that one day wage. This might say that about trade union. I say really, I don't want to be a member of Tesco. Only they make my money. What trade union? They take my money, but where is trade union? Company or trade union? Here. I think it means it's same. I know what trade unions go struggle against the big companies. In general, this approach more prevalent with Tescopish members. However, a few workers have different other outputs. For example, one of the workers from Migros, trade union is me. You and us, it's easy to raise a bad trade union. Why do you not want to change? Because it's hard. Our Turkish people like easy. I don't like administration, but I like trade union. I trade something. I will try to change this process with my friends. But our number is very limited. I said before, our people like easy. We witnessed interesting situation, especially because we are with development and subcontracted firm. And this foreign branch, Wilderness, is different from Migros. Transport brand of Wilderness, one of trade that applies with DISK, which is Latin Confederation, ability for organizing. One of what is said about this 33 years old male, this area, why are these different? Our conditions are so bad because we always take our wage with black. With black. Our firm is different. Already, Migros is not beneficial for it. Why we go to different firm? Real trade union is one way, or we should go for another way. I can't take risk. Always, I can't find a job that is cheap. It's in Turkish, I'm not in word. If I'm a donkey, you can find many men who hand to you pack leather. Marco and Jim's work is general, no, okay, I think.
Yeah, but I didn't know what I should have said as the time. I'm really here as the timekeeper. I know we can go on for, you know, for a real long time, but I know there's, we do have some other speakers. So you maybe just some, and I'll have leave time for maybe one or two questions, and then hopefully we'll have time at the end. But yeah, you can just.
Okay. Now we need the work is speaking on trade unions. One of the gives a worker who work in cooking department, I think Turkey says about, I'm a chief of cooking, for example. Also, is a skilled laborer, but generally they are workers unskilled. You can't find like that, maybe millions in a day. If owner do not like trade union, you might dismiss it, but I can't find a job everywhere, for example. However, I do not want trade union. I think it's unnecessary. I know the strong one of my friends, our wage are so low, but trade union cannot provide high wage. I know from my friend, what should we do? I don't know. Thanks to God, I try to realize my properly. If you do properly, if you are true, you will take your right. The man also work in a Islamic as a Islamic capital market, and his also worldwide approach affects Islamic and so reflects of main depths of. Their Islamic approach, and they don't want to have a trade union or something. It's enough to have a job. They don't want to improve their conditions. An interesting point, part-time social conditions, but full-time work, especially cashier girls in Migros. In supermarket retail chains, workers generally gain minimum wage. That is determined by state. It's merely $30-$50. However, many workers take this week late in nearly every month. In Turkey, regular work is not a true concept for job that's kind of market workers. Regular job every month is valid for only limited personnel. For example, in Migros, only secure personnel, and they can be ununion. A typical work is typical in Turkish condition. In generally, contracts are valid for 9 months. Because after buying a contract, if employer wants to dismiss, has to pay money. When employer wants to take work, this continuous and renewed contracts provide escape this obligation for the boss. But in practical situation, blocking severance pay for workers. A few workers benefit from only severance pay. Also, in subcontractor firms, many workers work without non-insured and be good though officially, but they work. Workers generally afraid from company, and some workers ask their social rights and other terms conditions to ask them in terms of that. This is an important data for this study. Also, I think control of work and solidarity between workers, but I think we finish and I say something about competition.
Well, but I like, you know, I hate to cut it off. I know it's a big discussion, and you're opened up a lot.
Okay.
So I'll give you just one closing comment, okay. and then I'll have. I wish I should have brought it in a gap.
Okay. Last point. Yeah. Today in Turkey, labor context requires a new type of trade unionism. Tradition is no effective. Labor life and workers' life. Maybe we can say we can debate about social movement trade unionism or flexible trade unionism, what we can say is, but traditional one is closed for Turkey, we think in our study. On the other hand, the last one, being unemployment and being workers is so
engaged category.
Category. It is not a real solution for shop floor trade unionism. Is not real in real life reality. In reality, so in life spaces and shop floors, trade unions can relate with each other. We can say in conclusion.
But I, you know, I was just listening a little bit. And a quick reflection. I mean, certainly, work issues are work issues. Whether it be parent, you know, with, I have two daughters of my own going to school, and just work balance issues, trade, and how things are rapidly changing, and how really there has to be an evolution of training with the situation and this whole kind of like folded in. I think the bigger, and it's going to take decades to do this, the whole idea of trade union globalization of all unions, and that goes from our United University professions, and not just the kind of day-to-day kind of things coming up. And so I think it was a great kickoff of this session.
Fundamental changes cannot be understanding only ineffective trade unions or rights promotion. It's a different period. And it requires a different type of trade unions.
And as I think you hit you, and that's a message not only for Turkey, but also for certainly the United States, or even as our Governor Patterson's looking to furlough state workers and layoffs and all kinds of things. It's a universal kind of message. But thanks again, gentlemen, for kicking us off. What I'd like to do now, we're going to try to keep this on track. So each speaker, we have three speakers. We're going to bring Nicole up, Lou Martin. He's our next speaker, and I'm interested in this also, his history from Chatham University. As a professor of history at Chatham, his talk is going to be Industrial Workers and the Shift to a Service Economy in West Virginia, 1950 through 1990. And I'm almost thinking my wife is from Buffalo, New York, and I try to bring up, you know, just almost to see when the whole Republican Steel and all those factories moved out. I mean, certainly what's been happening up in Buffalo, New York, I might hear some echoes, but you should know Lou is an assistant professor of history out of Chatham and Pittsburgh. Dissertation explored the culture of rural industrial workers in northern West Virginia in the 20th century. An article based on this work will be appearing in the journal Labor, Working Class History of the Americas, later this year. It's also published an article in Pennsylvania History that looked at the steel workers in small tin-plate towns in the early 1900s. And the new project focuses on this deindustrialization of West Virginia after World War II. His paper today is titled, as I said, this shift, and I think it's I think it'll blend in nice stuff. Luke, take it over.
Thanks, Ed. I don't have a fully realized paper, so I'll try to get back on track a little bit. I've just begun this project, and I'm still revising my dissertation, but I wanted to start something new, and so I'm interested in this big transition from industrial to service economy. And I'm still kind of carving out exactly what the topic is going to look like. In a nutshell, though, I can tell you that West Virginia in 1950, one in five working West Virginians worked in the coal mines. And only one in 20 worked in professional services. And that includes doctors, lawyers, nurses, school teachers, social workers, etc. By 1990, that flip-flopped. Only one in 20 worked in mines, and one in four now worked in professional services. And in fact, that has increased by 2,000. 30% of working West Virginians worked in professional services. I've got ideas about the history of deindustrialization that I'll pass on. And I've kind of figured out some milestones. One is the loss of coal mining jobs in the 1950s, the federal government's response to this loss of jobs in the 1960s, the loss of steel industry jobs in the 70s and 80s, And then in 1998, Walmart became the state's largest employer, beating out Wheaton Steel for the first time. But in 2009, NPR reported that Morgantown, West Virginia, had the nation's lowest unemployment rate at 2.7. And Morgantown, West Virginia, is a center of education and health care in the state. And that's more reflective, I think, of the new service economy. So I'm going to focus on the loss of mining jobs and a little bit of the federal government's response. During the 50s, West Virginia lost, let me give you the statistics. In 1948, they had 126,000 mining jobs. Within 6 years, half of those jobs disappeared because of switching to other fuels as well as mechanizing the mining process. They adopted continuous miners and machine loaders. And I say that my plan is to look at this loss of mining jobs in very much the same way that people looked at the steel industry and the automobile industry in the 80s. I say that they lost these jobs rapidly, but also gradually in some respects at the same time. Rapidly because it took many people by surprise. They were very shocked. Cecil McCormick said, I don't think anybody really saw it coming. I don't know many people that were prepared for it. Fayette County, West Virginia, had 11,000 coal miners in 1950, lost 75% of those jobs in 10 years. But it also happened gradually because the average coal mine only employed 200 or 300 people. No single mine closing was notable on a national scale. It was not newsworthy on a national scale. And so it kind of occurred silently. Many people were unaware that this was happening. And it also, miners could hold out hope that their job would remain because many mines did stay open and continue to produce as much coal as ever. But to the average reader of the New York Times, when they began to read about, in 1959, poverty in West Virginia, they might have thought of this as just in part of the same chain of sorrow that miners had experienced poverty in the 30s. They had gone through desperate times at the beginning of the 20th century. This probably seemed just like one more chapter in that story. Homer Bickert of the New York Times wrote an article in 1959 called West Virginia Grimm, and he talked about miner Melvin Smoot and his family of 8 children having to live on federal food surplus. They called it Molly Grub, 30 pounds of flour, 10 pounds of rice, and 5 pounds of butter per month, but that only lasted for 3 weeks, and they turned to local churches to survive. So, in fact, there were good times for miners that in between those terrible periods that people weren't aware of. The wages increased between 1935 and 1950 by 170%. That was after unionization, of course. So there were good times, but during the early 1950s, those came to an end for most miners. And there was a massive out-migration. Between 1940 and 1970, 3 million people left the Appalachian region. And some of the best work in Appalachian studies has examined these migrants who left the mountains. And they actually, a recent book by Chad Berry called Southern Migrants, Northern Exiles, finds that they did quite well in the north. They adjusted. They were able to get good jobs in automobile plants and rubber factories. But when people arrived in West Virginia in 1959 and 1960, they were shocked at the poverty that was left in the wake of this massive loss of jobs. And in 1960, John Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey came to West Virginia in a bid to become the Democratic nominee, and they drew attention to the poverty. In fact, John Kennedy used this as a talking point against the Republicans. He said, Mr. Nixon has said that Americans are living better today than ever before, and they're going to vote that way. But he hasn't been to West Virginia. He hasn't seen the thousands of miners who want work and can't find work. He hasn't seen the thousands of undernourished women and children. So this West Virginia, this poverty was, at this time in 1960, linked to the loss of mining jobs. That would change, though. As policymakers started to pass laws, the Area Redevelopment Act was supposed to stimulate growth in West Virginia, but proved ineffective. Quickly, they turned to other explanations. In 1960, the United States had seen its gross national product double in 15 years. How is it possible that these people can't adjust? There must be something wrong with them. And so they turned to the culture of poverty theory to explain what was wrong with West Virginia. Michael Harrington's bestseller, The Other America, said that West Virginia was a clear example of how a social problem became a personal failure. He said that in some of the West Virginia towns, an entire community will become shabby and defeated. The entire area becomes permeated with failure, he said. So that in a chapter titled The Rejects, he said that coal miners had many positive qualities, but they were tied to their place. He said, riding through the coal and steel towns of Pennsylvania and West Virginia, it is hard for the outsider to imagine people developing affection for these gouged and scarred hills. But the fact is, they do. Many of the war on poverty programs that started in 1964 and 65 were embedded with these assumptions about the helplessness and dependency of these people who were suffering poverty in West Virginia and other places, Detroit, all these places that had, many of them had either been hit by deindustrialization or there was a lower standard of living in rural areas. Both of those were true in West Virginia. A new study of the Volunteers in Service to America exposes some of these assumptions. This is a book by Thomas Kiffmeyer. And their programs were, they would give school children a photo tour of Mexico to awaken their imagination that a world existed beyond the mountains and that maybe they too could escape this poverty and the culture of poverty. They also would bring in foreign exchange students to talk about their home countries. And they took them on school trips to the state capital to show them the big city. This, of course, ignored the fact that Appalachians were leaving already by tens of thousands, 3 million by 1970. But one of the other programs was the Community Action Programs. This was designed to, once again, sort of awaken the poor people and have them solve their own problems. And the VISTA volunteers in West Virginia and Kentucky and other places helped bring formal organization to a movement that was already underway to fight strip mining, in the case of the organization Appalachians to Save the Land and the People, and to fight for black lung benefits. And there was a third example that I had that was brilliant, of course. fighting corruption in the United Mine Workers. This was another project that the VISTA volunteers kind of got into late in the 60s. The irony was that these young college students were radicalized by the experience. One volunteer recalled, "I felt like I was radicalized or politicized or whatever by the people who lived in the mountains themselves." Another poverty warrior wrote, "I used to think that what was needed was to bring mountain people into the economic mainstream. I thought it would be possible to do this and still preserve some of the positive humanizing qualities of mountain cultures," he wrote. "I no longer think this is possible or desirable." In fact, he said that Americans might be able to learn something from these poor people in West Virginia. So I think that by looking at these two things together, putting deindustrialization back in the story, it gives us a new context. But I also hope to look at this on a local level and really tell the story in a more empirical way, rather than these broad generalizations that tended to fuel stereotypes and other problems. I also think that it's interesting to look at the gap between government solutions and what working people actually did to make adjustments, and that we continue to face this problem. Maybe we could actually learn something from those people who survived that adjustment in the 1960s. Okay, thanks.
Job and you did with back on track, and I'm sure Mike's wife will appreciate that. So we can open up. We have some time for questions. And from the floor, Lou, if you want to take any at this point.
Is this for both?
Yes, we can. We do. Great. I'll bring back the first thanks to Lou.
First question is to the first presenter, and I apologize for not remembering your name. I probably wouldn't have pronounced it anyway. I was intrigued by your use of the term trendy trade unions. I don't think we have any trendy trade unions in.
Trendy.
Tun has Tuni, for example. One of them is right, other is gas in Turkish language.
And last year, the AKP government have a pro-Islamic worldview, Teo and neoliberal. We use in Turkish, maybe opponent people say this Teo liberal.
Islamic and also capitalist. Very capitalist also, and also they give permission to unions, they tend to themselves, others never. For example, in Turkey, tobacco workers resistance in states and also occupied the streets in Ankara, capital city, especially President Turkey, reacted very, very badly to the workers, for example. They don't want to work. Say, even they don't want to work, they have money. And they are provocative also, so many things to save them. But ironically, many tobacco workers voted in general elections AKP. Many of them are conservative people, in fact. But also they are worker, and sometimes happens a good thing in Turkish worker class. They got consensus when they are assisting the government. They feel themselves as a worker, different from government's approach, if they accept the conservative people. They are conservative, but also they are rich. But we are conservative, also we are worker. Separated happens based on class. First time in tobacco workers. It's an interesting point in Turkey, for example, last 20 years never happened a strike like this, not a resistance like this.
In some Turkish is a traditional state supported trade union. In Hakish, for Hakish, in last 10 years for AKP government, is it trendy, state-supported trade unions for using state companies and workers?
I'd like to bring it back to Lou on one point.
and where, well, like the way you're hitting it as far as the story, almost like this reverse ministry. In other words, listening to those stories on how they did adapt and change, and even as the stats of that flip, also from who was in labor, coal miner versus now profession, with a center core around education, surprisingly enough, and also healthcare. I think you're really hitting those right points. In addition to the idea of this gradual change, seeing the trend, but not really wanting to see it. And I think it's this whole idea of deep change that is so hard for people to accept, that this, you know, the sense of loss of this way of life and this cultural kind of themes, versus the choice of slow death. And that's what I think you see in that, when given the choice, and it's almost like the psychological thing that even, and I think unions have to fight this so much. These are the traditions, this is what we're having right now, whether it be, this is our contract, and we have this contract, and you know, we're talking about furloughs within New York State, or layoffs, and we have this budget crisis. The whole idea of, well, contract's a contract, and how does the unions negotiate that? I mean, when there is a contract, and this whole idea, what for? And New York being able to face this whole idea of differential tuition, or whoever it might be, this new plan, or this new strategic plan that's being rolled out, but it means an irreversible change. There's no going back. I mean, that's where, again, this choice, and when given this idea of deep change, people are, you know, will go with gradual change. This idea of a deep change, this paradigm shift that has to go on, I think really winds up being the point. But I think by doing the lessons and seeing how people do adjust in time, I think is really much of something. And again, whether it's Pittsburgh, Western New York, it's happening, and it's always happening. This idea of the cheese is always moving, and that's something that we can't settle, you know, kind of settle in. But even get that psychological report and pull out the lessons, and I think that would be valuable. Those are within, again, I'm bringing it back to what we're going through within SUNY, as we have a new chancellor and the president and stuff. Yeah, that's
are we still ahead of time?
Yes, we have to jump in. Thanks, Lou, again. Yeah. I'm giving you full credit for it.
Right. For Philip Morgan, it sounds like fascinating work. I was just rereading the re-release of the Harlan County Wars book, whose author is escaping me, but one of the things he does wonderfully in there is point out that for areas like West Virginia and Harlan County, coal mining is not time immemorial, right? There's a period when coal mining comes to that area, and it changes something that's already there. So it's not like these people were always connected to coal mining as well. They weren't always connected to wage labor, so there's no other change in it. And then one of the things that I find fascinating about these changes to the service economy is how during the time when it's dominated by a single industry, there are things going on that the working people there are probably not even aware that they're doing that are creating the spaces that are setting it up to the service economy. I was wondering, I know this is preliminary research, but I was wondering if you were looking into the types of communities that they were creating and what set up, because the service economy can't just appear, you know, out of nowhere. There has to be a reason for things to locate there. And like Mark, I'm sorry, where West Virginia University is.
Morgantown,
yeah. And the other thing I was struggling with is the similarity of language between people like, names are killing me, but the report you read and some of the visitor workers and social workers from the turn of the century working in cities, saying that almost the exact same thing about these populations, and then saying the exact same thing after working with them, like, wow, no, there's something there that we don't understand and that we're trying to impose upon. So it sounds like great work, but I was wondering how far you've gotten with what you're doing.
Well, as far as why those places like Morgantown became service centers of service economy in the state, I think Robert Byrd gets bashed a lot for his Klan activity back in the 40s, Ku Klux Klan, but between over the last 30 years, he's brought a lot of pork barrel to West Virginia, and that has shaped the service economy in a big way. All kinds of research dollars for the universities, new hospitals and medical research centers, and then that's had a multiplier effect. And also, the population has got a lot older when those hundreds of thousands of people left. And so this aged population with its Medicare dollars is also, I think, fueling the places where there was hospitals and health clinics and places like that. And of course, the college enrollment in the state has gone up along with all these Stafford loans and everything. So I think the federal government has had a huge role in creating this service economy. And I also wonder what will happen when that bubble passes and when we can't pay our student loans and all of these other calamities that could be over the horizon. You know, there might be another transition for West Virginians to go through.
Okay, anyone have anything else? Okay, so with that, I'd like our last speaker coming up. I think, Rakeem, you're ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and I think it blends in nice. I like the way how the committee put together the program. And just a real quick, Rakeem is assistant professor of labor studies, the labor studies program at Indiana University, School of Social Work, and really has a great background. And certainly he's done a lot of research interest lies in issues involving dislocated workers, a lot of things such as social stratification, income inequity, and poverty as they pertain to workers and workers' education. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I really enjoyed the two previous presentations, and I was also interested in the term that you used, before marriage woman. It's been a long time since I was a before marriage woman. Trying to put myself back in that place where I would think about work in Turkey. I enjoyed your presentation as well. What I wanted to share with you today is also a work in progress. So this is really more of a formative evaluation on a study that I'm conducting about organizing housekeepers in Indianapolis, Indiana, in three major downtown motels, the Westin, the Sheraton, and the Hilton. These are major motels in Indy as well as across the United States and then other countries as well. And so I became very interested in helping to organize the housekeepers through a couple of community organizers in Indy who called me, and came by my office and said, would you help us with this endeavor? And I said, sure. I was a bit of an organizer in a previous life before I entered academia. So I was more than happy to help with that. And then I became very interested in the stories that these housekeepers had to share. So this is a qualitative work and involves surveys that are in the process of being sent out. There are a little fewer than 200, 194, 195, something like that. Surveys that are being sent out to all of these housekeepers, complements of the Unite Here union and AFSCME. The AFSCME union is also involved with this, as well as its Jobs with Justice. So the surveys are in the process of going out, and the data that I'm going to be collecting from this survey is going to ask a litany of questions to these housekeepers, things like, do you have to work through your break? Do you get any compensation for that? Do you go home tired? When you go home, are you able to play with your children and fix dinner and do the things that most of us consider important to do in our leisure time? Leisure time being defined as time away from work. Are your community organizers helpful and disseminating information to you that you can understand? Most of these housekeepers are Latino. Most of them do not have English as their first language. And so the surveys had to, many of them anyway, be translated into another language so that these primarily women could understand the questions I was asking. I'm also asking these ladies, and they are all ladies, to consent to participate in focus groups, and within those focus groups I will be collecting some more in-depth qualitative data about their lives.
One of the things that I was interested in, the primary focus of this study, will be their cultural heritage and the barriers to organizing that that might present. And so I want to look at things like the way they were brought up. Does that have any impact on organizing into a union? Is there any hesitancy about joining a union because of maybe the social mores that they may have brought to this country? You have to understand that many of these workers may be here as undocumented workers. And so there may be some hesitancy in sharing information with me about that. So we have a lot of aspects that of this study that we're looking at. What I primarily wanted to share with you today was kind of the background for this study, and that primarily has to do with the Hotel Workers Rising Campaign, which is a national campaign here in the States and in Canada as well. Housekeepers are generally an invisible force. When you check into a motel, you normally don't see the housekeepers. You might run into one of them in the hall or something, but they're kind of the back of the shop, the invisible workforce that really keep the motel running and the hotel running. So they provide you the clean rooms and this, the amenities that you have. You run out of towels, you're going to call a housekeeper, and they're going to bring those things to you. And so sometimes we call them room attendants, maids, service workers, but they're a very vital component to the hotel industry. So without this invisible workforce, the hotel industry wouldn't function, or at least it wouldn't function very well. For instance, I have a problem with my hotel room with the bathtub while I've been here, and I'm having a great deal of trouble getting that fixed. I've made three requests, and I still don't have that fixed yet. So I'm trying to deal with management on that issue. So the housekeepers in Indianapolis are a part of this invisible workforce that are being asked to do more work for less pay. Average pay for Indian housekeepers is $7.50 an hour. They have no benefits. Most of them live away from the motel, so sometimes the motel will provide bus passes to get them back and forth to work. Generally, they either walk to work or ride a bus to work. They are primarily women of color who are disadvantaged via the processes and the structures that are dependent upon cheap and gendered and segregated and racialized labor. So these particular women really feel that they have no choice available to them but to work in this service industry. They generally don't have an education that would allow them to move into another arena, even if there were jobs in other arenas available to them. So the ability of the hotel industry to utilize low-wage labor allows the corporate hotel structure to blossom and bloom and grow at the expense of these workers. And attempting to convince these workers that by bringing a union in which they could band together through solidarity to empower themselves, has been a difficult challenge. There are a few of them on board at this point, so it's certainly still a work in progress, as of this study. One of the things that housekeepers are being asked to do, other than more with less, is because of the downtown capacities in most large cities, which many times are called global cities, to attract financial capital. So big cities like Toronto and London and Chicago, the bigger cities, they attract financial capital, and so fat cats come in here and want to stay at these really nice hotels. To entice this clientele, this very specific clientele, the rooms have been spiffed up. And so you want to provide, if you're the corporate motel chain, you want to provide to these customers a nice home away from home. So consequently, the rooms have become small Taj Mahals in which there are huge mirrors to clean. They have put in each motel room what they call a heavenly bed. The Heavenly Bed's mattress weighs 150 pounds. It has 14 pieces of linen and pillows that have to be put on it and taken off of it each day. There are 142 movements that a maid or a housekeeper has to engage in to get the sheets and the pillows all off the beds and back on the beds. The housekeepers in Indy clean 30 of these rooms in an 8-hour shift. They don't drink water during the day because that would mean they would have to go to the bathroom. They don't have time to do that. They don't take their breaks because management tells them that they have to complete their shift before they can leave, and many of them have to stay afterwards to finish that work, and they don't get any kind of remuneration for that. So this is unpaid overtime. This is unpaid break time. And it is really, it really truly falls into the category of abuse to workers. Now, because Indianapolis is not a labor-friendly town, as many of the towns in which you live may not be, we have decided to frame this issue not necessarily as a human issue, but we've decided to frame it as a women's issue. And so we are reaching out into the community and building coalitions through many faith-based groups.